सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ Now we are continuing the discussion. I was just wondering how I may continue this discussion from where we left yesterday, because yesterday, towards the end of the question-answer session, there was some discussion about the four stages of human life. We call, maybe in the old Sanskrit name, it is called Chaturashrama, four stages. It's common to all people, where we begin our life, learning, being a student, preparing ourselves. All people do to become ideal citizens of the country, ideal members of the family, ideal sons and daughters, parents, and of course, responsible members of the society. Now, there are two fundamental values which are common to all people in modern times. One is success, the other is happiness. So everyone wants happiness. There is no doubt about it. So, and everyone wants success. Now, what's the true meaning of success? And what's the true meaning of happiness? Now, if you talk in modern times about restraint, contentment, the ability to say enough, no more. If you talk on these lines, there could be some murmur from some quarters. Because all over the country, people are paying thousands of dollars every year to become smarter and more successful. So how to make more profit, how to become more successful? Every year, and people pay, maybe in some, at a higher levels, the executives pay maybe $500 per session. Maybe one session, maybe 3-4 hours a day. Now the whole point is, how can you talk about restraint in such a niche? So there we had to define what is meant by being smart, being successful. Now suppose we become very successful as businessmen, which is needed. We should not run away, we cannot run away from the reality of the present empirical world, demands and compulsions. If you run away from it, then people say these ideas are totally unpractical. And you know, utilitarianism is the reigning monarch of our times, you know. We cannot run away from this fact. So we are not compromising the highest spiritual ideal to suit the demands of our times. But the scripture, Vedanta scriptures themselves lay down some fundamental definitions of what is meant by success, what is meant by happiness. Now one central point that we all feel in today's world is, if you go for happiness, you won't get it. So there is an element of self-defeatism in it. When we chase it, it eludes us. We never get it. So whatever we go after, we don't get. There's no doubt about it. And this is a fact of real life. As I mentioned yesterday, you know, we can predict, we can determine, we can regulate, we can be sure as to how a machine, the most complex machine in the world, is going to function. We can be very sure about it. And to some extent, we can be sure about how our senses of action are going to function. It is our choice whether we should turn to the left or right, to the west or east. We can do. But as I mentioned yesterday, we can never be sure about the functions of our mind. What thought is going to emerge in our mind? And thoughts are sure to influence our actions. There is no doubt about it. So Vedanta, lays down certain very important principles of what is meant by success. Success is defined, or happiness is defined in Vedanta, by the Sanskrit word prasada. So that's the real word used here. Prasada is not joy or satisfaction, but it includes joy and satisfaction, no doubt, but goes far beyond it. As I mentioned yesterday, any kind of happiness or joy, an empirical worldly sense, is not happiness or joy, rather it is only the opposite of it. And that too is a temporary experience. That situation will change very fast. So what is prasada? Prasada is a state of mental condition. When we do something, if we feel a kind of inner perfection, inner fulfillment, inner completeness, difficult to explain. Everyone is seeking that. Actually, everyone is seeking. Only they are seeking only the lower levels of that prasada. If the people who take to alcoholic drinks to forget the everyday problems, the problems of everyday life situations, are trying to get this, but they think they can get it by running away from problems, which really is not the wisest way to do that. People who give their whole life to make efforts, to make money, think that money will give them this prasada. But the whole point is, though intellectually we know it is not going to happen, still we develop a kind of inner joy in making an effort to get something which we know very well is not going to give us everlasting happiness or peace. There are a very few important verses in the Gita which explains prasada. So prasada gives you a true meaning into the psychology of happiness and psychology of real success and real creativity. So as I mentioned, happiness is the goal of human life, but happiness is never achieved by making an effort in that direction. Now, in the Gita, there is a famous word which says, prasade sarva dukkhanam khani rasyopajayade prasanna chedasohyasu buddhi paryavatishthade. This is the verse. Another verse is, ragadvesha viyuktaistu vishyan indriyaisharan atmavasyer vidheyatma prasadam adigachati. So there are two verses which are very, very important. So what is prasada? Prasada is the inner contentment which remains everlasting, which never changes. If you do something, and when we look back and we feel a kind of joy, satisfaction, inner fulfillment, that experience is prasada, and what actually causes that experience is called true creativity according to Vedanta. To give an example, I can quote one part of the Ishavasya Upanishad. It's one of the most ancient verses. This Upanishad begins with a great statement. It's highly metaphysical, highly spiritual. The statement is, Ishavasyam idam sarvam yat kinja jagatyam jagatena tektena bunchitaha ma grudhakasya suddharam. The first part makes a statement. The entire creation, the whole world is pervaded by the divine. That's what it means. Therefore, every action can become an act of worship. Every word can become a secret prayer. Every thought can become a meditation. The whole life can be spiritualized if you take the right approach. How to do that? We can enjoy this world, as I mentioned yesterday. We can have happiness. But as I mentioned, if you go for happiness, you won't get it. So how to get real happiness? By not looking for happiness. It doesn't mean that we should not react or respond when there is an unhappy experience. Not at all. Vedanta never preaches passivity, inaction, lethargy, or being irresponsible. It's not at all. In fact, if a lazy man comes to you and say that he wants the highest prasada, then what you should do, you should ask him to work hard and to make enough to make both ends meet. And then still if he feels a kind of inner happiness, he can look for higher spiritual joy. So Vedanta is not a flight, not a running away from the world of realities. So the first statement makes a great spiritual motto. That is, the whole creation is pervaded by the divine. Then it says, so how to live in this world? So you can live in this world, you can enjoy this world by giving up enjoyment, by giving up attachment, too much of obsessive attachment towards enjoyment. Once we learn that, we will start enjoying this world. And that's a real success. So maybe after some decades, and when we reach a very high level of industrial development, economic advancement, even in the so-called third world countries and less developed countries, when humanity reaches a higher level of economic sustenance and development, even the so-called poor countries, then we may have to look for a new definition for happiness and success. So, here, Isavasya Upanishad is presenting an idea. It addresses those who have worked hard, have made enough in this world, and who have succeeded, who have been pursuing happiness through success, thinking that success in the ordinary empirical sense, worldly sense, can bring happiness. To such people who are still finding some inner void, emptiness, some problem, you know, most of us have problems not because we are poor, but we don't have enough to eat and we don't have enough cloth or anything. We are facing a problem even after fulfilling all the ordinary demands of human existence. So how to look for happiness? So Isavasya Upanishad, tena tek tena bunchitaha. I mean, keep in mind the idea that all this belongs to the divine. Still, live in this world, enjoy this world. But that enjoyment is done through renunciation. I mean, by combining a kind of transcendental spiritual ideal plus awareness of the everyday demands and requirements of the world. So, tena tyaktena bunchithaha magrita kasyasudhanam. The next verse I am not going to explain, but the verse is this. Kurvanneva iha karmani ji visheshatam samaha evam tuin anyat hiduosti na karma lippeti nara. Literal meaning is important to understand to really appreciate what I am going to state next. So it says, so live in this world and try to live, have a desire to live for 100 years. Work hard, make enough wealth, but be unattached or non-attached. How to remain non-attached? Live in this world, but understand the enjoyments and happiness that the world gives you are not going to be everlasting. Keep this awareness in mind. there is something higher you have to look for if you want real success, real happiness. Now suppose you have led such a life for a long time and we have reached maybe 100th year. What will be the natural thoughts of a person who is about to die? Remember, again you have to remember, we are talking about the Ishavasya Upanishad, which takes for granted that life is not one chance. Otherwise, at the end is always misery. Old age is misery. Old age is a big problem. Old age means society in modern times rejects those who are old, thinking that old are useless. That's a great curse of modern society. By rejecting the old, by rejecting the succession, what we call in Sanskrit called parampara, the wisdom of the sages, the wisdom of the saints, who quote Socrates, Plato, Aristotle in modern times. People quote more neo-positivists, utilitarians, and, well, I don't want to go through details, the point is. So the whole approach is based on, in modern times, based on utilitarian perspective. On the other hand, if you remember that we are in distinguished company, we are the inheritors of great spiritual wisdom. Maybe in the Greco-Roman tradition, we have got a sage like Socrates. In the Oriental tradition, we have got Lao Tzu, the great Vedic sages, Buddha, Shankara, of course in modern times, great men like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, and so on. Once we can remember that we are the inheritors of this invisible but strongly felt and experienced spiritual legacy, then we will be in distinguished company. So the Upanishad understands this very well. Secondly, this Upanishad takes it for granted that life is not one chance. When you are born again, you will be born to continue your spiritual evolution from where you have left in this life. So the prayer is this: a dying man is praying to God and pleading to his own mind, "O mind, go back and think of the wonderful deeds you have done, the wonderful words you have spoken, the wonderful thoughts you have thought. O Kridamsmara, Kridosmara." Of course, he begins with the prayer, Hiranmayena Patrana, which I am not going to quote because this is not a discussion on the Upanishads. But the last prayer is very touching and very relevant. How an intelligent person who has led an intelligent life and who is trying to die as an intelligent person is asking, pleading to his own mind, turn back, go back to the earlier days, when you did good things, when you did noble deeds, when you thought noble thoughts, when you spoke noble words, what all wonderful things that you did, of which you can be proud, you can be happy, you can have this prasada. Why? Of course, there is a reason for it. Depending upon the thought currents that we have accumulated in the mind, the last thought of a dying man will appear before him in the subtle form. So the thought current or the impressions of a dying man will be the sum total of all the good thoughts or bad thoughts, whatever may be, that he has done or he has thought. But here this man is pleading to his own mind, "Mind, don't bring to the surface your bad thoughts. Bring to the surface the good thoughts." Now, to be able to pray like that, we must have led an intelligent life or lived our life intelligently. Then we will have prasada. So what is prasada? Prasada is not the happiness that you get when you get a huge bank balance. It's not prasada. It can even be the opposite of it. So the real meaning of prasada is this inner contentment. For that we need a psychological refinement. He says, Raga dvesha viyukta istu visayan indriyesharan atma vasya vidheya atma prasadam adhigacchati. What the verse says, when you have transcended both attraction towards so-called happy experiences, happy objects, and aversion towards those which you don't like. When you have realized that you are actually something that is beyond this body, mind, or intellect, you have got a spiritual dimension to your personality. And then you learn to be happy when you remember that you have the spiritual dimension. When we develop these skills, then we can have prasada. So, it's a very interesting point. In a way, prasada even helps you to sublimate our creative skills. That's an interesting subject here. Prasada is not just an inner spiritual contemplative experience. It has got a very visible, intensely felt external form. It helps us to sublimate, to refine our creative skills, creativity, true creativity. Because without prasada, when we do things out of either extreme attachment or liking, you are extreme kind of attachment or liking for something, or it's opposite, aversion, hatred to something. These two are called the two extremes of the mental world. Because our mind functions in the form of a triangle. On the one hand, we have experience, which is called bhoga in Sanskrit. Then, two types of responses to that experience. One response could be raga, means extreme attachment, liking for certain things. Those things may not be good for us. There are certain things that we know, maybe intellectually, we know it's not good for us. But we can't help keeping our mind attached to it. It's called attachment. Attachment, in this sense, has got a deep psychological implication. Normally, you know, it is not attachment of a mother to her child or a child to his mother or her mother. No. What is meant by attachment or, raga in Sanskrit word is this. A kind of liking for things that makes you spiritually enslaved, that keep you spiritually enslaved. You want to get out of it. You know it's not good for us. You know it's a bondage. And we have a sincere inner desire to get out of it. But we are not able to do it. It is called raga. It is a kind of obsession, obsessive attachment. It's opposite dvesha. These are two types of our responses to experiences. Either inner experiences like happiness or unhappiness, hunger or thirst, or external objects. How we respond to external objects, to persons, individuals, different reactions from external world. Either extreme obsessive attachments. We want to get out of it, but we cannot. Because there is always a conflict between mind and intellect. The intellect wants to help you to get out of it. Because you know it's not good for us. But the mind won't allow you. Mind creates a mental block. It's a conflict between where mind stands and intellect stands. The influence of intellect in our real life is very, very superficial in ordinary human beings. It is mind that dominates our emotions, feelings, and ideas. We all live at mental level, mostly. So, this is how the mental world functions. Now, the whole point is, this aversion and this obsession, we create strong vrittis and vasanas, extreme kinds of obsessions, conflicts, and in modern language of psychiatry called phobias, obsessions, both, you know, one of, obsession of type, one type, phobia another type. So there is a solution to this. So Vedanta says, once we try to remember that mind is only a very insignificant, superficial dimension of my true personality. I have a higher dimension. I am the Atman, which is born every life, which accumulates good samskaras and bad samskaras, which again continue its evolution till it realizes its true nature. This evolution continues. Once we understand this true spiritual dimension of a personality, immediately we get out of the clutches of these samskaras, obsessions, and also aversions. And the easiest way and the most logical way to enjoy this inner happiness is to remember, to keep in mind that I have a higher dimension. Even in ordinary life, suppose a big problem creates a big dilemma, stress, tension, economic life or any life. At the time we can remember, well, that is true. We have to work in the world. We have to face the challenges. Work hard, work efficiently. But keep in mind, well, the real I has got a spiritual dimension. Everything else is relative. So once we are able to look at this world and all its problems from a higher perspective, then the problems appear to be lesser problems. Problems will be there. We have to work. But the point is, we will be able to look at them from a higher perspective. For that, Patanjali lays down certain fundamental disciplines, which I tried to explain today. The first set of disciplines are called Yama. I'm not going to deal with all the five disciplines, which are called Yama, which are universal disciplines, Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Aparigraha. But two things I'm going to deal with, which is very important, Asteya and Aparigraha. Because these two Yamas are important. In the next set of values called Niyamas, Sauja Santosha Tapaswadhyaya Isharpanithana. The Santosha is very important. Because Santosha is exactly the result of this Chitta Prasada, contentment. So we may explain Chitta Prasada as a kind of inner contentment. Santosha. When you get it, you get the feeling, well, you get the feeling that you have got something, you have achieved something which is really worthwhile in a very simple language. So kridarthata and kridakrityata, two words are. One word means kridartha, means you are looking for something, you have got it. You don't have to strive further. This never happens at the worldly level. You get one promotion, then you're looking for a higher. Get $1 trillion and maybe $2 trillion, billion, maybe not trillion, maybe whatever, million, billion, trillion. There's no end to that. So this is enough for me. There are of course great people, you know, that we cannot rule out. There are great men and great women who have succeeded so much, but who also learn to tell themselves enough. But that's because they have read these ideas. They have got these ideas not necessarily from the same scripture. These ideas are found in many, many great universal spiritual classics of all religious traditions you find. There is no religious tradition or spiritual tradition which doesn't teach us to say enough. It's a fundamental point. And the ability to say enough is the doorway to inner contentment. Now, it is not that we shut the door, rather we go beyond it. We transcend the lower levels. But the technical language we use it to say enough is a very empirical language, pedestrian language. What really happens is we transcend the lower levels of contentment and satisfaction, then we get citta prasada. Now, as I said earlier, Patanjali uses two words. In the Yama category, he uses asteya and abharigraha. And Niyama category, he used the word santosha. Santosha means contentment. Asteya literally means non-stealing. Abharigraha means non-receiving of gifts. It's an old language, you know. So what it means is freedom from greed, freedom from desire for things that we do not really require. We may intellectually know, but mind goes after it. So that's a big problem. If all people can live up to what they intellectually know, there'll be no problem in the world. Everyone knows greed is not good. Everyone knows. So, but then that's an intellectual level. But the mind won't cooperate with you. As I said earlier, we live at the mental level. So how to bridge the gap between the mind and intellect? That's the whole of spiritual practice. Spiritual practice is nothing but trying to bridge the gap between where the intellect stands and mind stands. In modern times, everyone knows, as I said, intellectually everyone knows that greed is not good. Freedom from greed is the only way to happiness, but the mind is not really willing to cooperate. Then the next, the Niyama category called Santosha means contentment. So the means for contentment is freedom from greed. But how to bridge the gap between mind and intellect? For that, Patanjali himself give some clues. He uses one word, Ishwara Pranidhana, Ishwara Pranidhana Dva. He gives a kind of vikalpa, you know, alternate. Even if you cannot practice any other discipline, any of these disciplines, if you just surrender yourself to God, then it is possible for you to feel inner contentment. That's why, you know, Lord Krishna gives a list of the characteristics of ideal devotee. And what he says, Sandushta Satatam Yogi Yatatma Dhridhanischaya. The point is, one should have inner contentment. Contentment is the sign of spiritual evolution. It doesn't mean that person will be inactive, will be sitting, sleeping all the time. No. It is not lethargy. It is not lack of creativity or lack of activity. He may be active 24 hours, but if he loses something, it doesn't shock him. That's the only difference. Otherwise, you know, very often this could be very easily interpreted as total inaction. In fact, many lazy, inactive people are very greedy. Only they are not willing to put up enough effort, actually. Or they may have some other quick means. They'll be very happy to have all of them. So, even after achieving all this, or after possessing all this, still if we can have contentment or look for that inner contentment, that is real, that's a purpose, that's a means for real happiness, which is called Atyantikam Sukham. Gita says Sukham Atyantikam Yatat Buddhi Grahim Atyantikam. The real sukha, the real happiness goes beyond happiness and unhappiness. True happiness is not happiness at the worldly level, sensory level. It's the happiness which is called chit prasada. As I mentioned, you can, all of us do feel it in varying degrees. When we do something, when we attend retreats, even we may not be able to fully understand, or we may even fully agree with what we discussed here. But still, when we, I have listened to something worthwhile, because we don't get anything out of it. Still, we strive for that. And out of making an effort for it, we get a kind of inner feeling of fulfillment. That is called with Chitta Prasada. So, now one may ask, there are various ways of interpreting these subjects. Sometimes we, as I mentioned yesterday, I discussed this point, whatever effort we make, not only physical effort, even a mental effort, a thought, an idea, a concept, for higher life, spiritual life, even that creates a kind of impression, that registers a vritti in our system. As I mentioned yesterday, it is invisible, but very strongly felt, and we live upon it. That is actually what constitutes Chitta Prasada. You have done something, maybe some years back, you look back, oh, I have done something. That you get a kind of inner fulfillment, feeling, a blessed feeling. Without that, nobody can persist in doing great things. Even if you, not only in Vedanta, if you read the autobiographical writings of Saint Teresa of Avila, you find she had to go through a lot of difficulties. Lot of difficulties. And still she persisted. What enabled her to persist, to continue her effort, spiritual sadhana, spiritual practices. Because in return for her effort, she was getting the inner feeling that God is protecting her, that she is making the right effort. In fact, that is the first sign that tells us that we are on the right track. Now, as I mentioned, the least effort is itself a great boon. There are many interesting narrations from the classics which demonstrate this. There's one interesting, a very touching story. It comes from the Bhagavata Purana. It's a story of a very unfortunate person. He was born in a pious family and his parents brought him up as a very God-fearing, obedient son. But when he reached his youth, he had a deviation and he started leading the life of a profligate. I mean, took to all kinds of undesirable activities. I mean, in short. And he led a very wayward kind of life. Totally different from the way he was brought up. He ill-treated his parents who met with tragedies. And finally, he was rejected by his own unworthy companions. When he squandered all the money, they abandoned him, and he was in his deathbed. The story gives a very important message. It is not a tragic story. There is an element of optimism at the end of the story. That's why it's so very important. So this man, as I mentioned, had led a very good life when he was young, a young boy. He was brought up as a God-fearing person. Then he became a profligate. He led a very wayward, immoral life. And then when he became old, he was in his deathbed and he was in a very wretched, miserable condition. And the last moment, you know, when his senses became weak and mind became weak, you cannot control your thoughts and actions. So your natural, spontaneous, your naturally accumulated thought currents will come to the surface. So he just crying and weeping, he called one name. The name was the name of his son. The name was Narayana. Now the name, incidentally, is also one of the synonyms of God in Hinduism. Because he was about to die, he All his unworthy companions have abandoned him, deserted him. He was in a very wretched state of affairs. So he lamented and called to his side his son, whose name was Narayana, who was the... That's all, that name also is a synonym of God in Hindu tradition. Now, immediately, it so happened that the angels from heaven came to his side to take him to heaven, to Vishnu Loka, means divine abode of God, so to speak. But then the devil also sent these messengers because he had done all evil things. So the devil thought, Satan thought that he belongs to him. He sent his messengers to drag him to hellfire. Naraka, I mean Surga, Vishnu Loka and Suraka. There's a debate between these two wonderful people. They wanted to claim this man, each group. At the end of it, the messengers who came from God taught the messengers from Satan. What was the teaching they gave? Look here. This man, at the last moment, called on to the name of God. That's why we came, and so he belongs to us. And they took him to the abode of God. He was liberated. That's the story. Now, that is only the superficial aspect of the story. There's a deeper story behind, a deeper message. How could he call the name of his son? And why did God send his messengers to bring him to heaven? The reason was this. As soon as he called his son, without really thinking about God, what happened was his mind immediately went back to his early days. Because he was chanting that name every day during his worship and meditation. And that name is the holy name of God, Narayana, which he incidentally gave to his own son. Because when the son was born, he was a good man. His son was born before he had a deviation, immoral deviation in his life. So he was a God-fearing man at that time. So he gave his son a name which was a synonym of God. And that was the name that he was uttering as a small boy during his worship and meditation. So without thinking, without remembering that that's a synonym of God, he called his son, not God. But because of the vrittis and vasanas and samskaras, good impressions that are gathered in his mental system, lying at the bottom layers of his mind, like a lake, you know, different layers. Those memories suddenly came to the surface, and he thought of the wonderful days when he was a young boy, he was leading a very pious life. So because of that, the idea of God came to his mind, so he was sent to heaven. This is a story behind. This comes into one of the interpretations, Sanskrit interpretations of this story. So what does it mean? It means even a little effort on our part to achieve this prasada, even an effort to do good things, to think good deeds, to feed our mind with good, positive, spiritual food, will help us eventually to experience this inner contentment. This is the highest philosophy. At the ordinary life situation, we can say, in the midst of all obligations and responsibilities, if we can make an effort to do something good, that effort, at least that decision, that desire to do good, will create a tremendous effect in the mental system. that will remain there. Unfortunately, you know, in modern times, all our efforts to solve problems are done at the superficial level. So it is good, it certainly plays some role, but beyond all that, there is no program for feeding the mind with good food. Just as when we eat bad food, our body becomes sick. So also, when we feed the mind with bad food, the mind also gets sick. So one important method to keep the mind in a state of what I said, prasada, means a kind of inner contentment, is to go to try or to keep trying to feed our mind with good, positive, spiritual food. Along with all actions, do some good actions. Along with all the responsibilities, there should be one section of our in our life where we devote some effort. It could be by reading some good scriptures, discussing spiritual ideas. People use internet and computer and YouTube. There are wonderful spiritual food also available in the internet. And also its opposite. So there are wonderful things available. Modern science and technology have opened many new channels which can be given a creative, even a spiritual orientation. Otherwise, you know, science and technology can give us tools for making our physical, material life more comfortable. It can give us powers over the five elements of nature. And also the knowledge, as I mentioned, to make our life, physical life, more comfortable. But science and technology cannot teach us to make proper use of the gifts of their gifts. It's called wisdom. That wisdom we get only from tradition. As I mentioned, you know, okay, this is a very important thing. We live in the present, be now, today, now. And such ideas are wonderful in innovation. It helps you in information technology. It helps you in economic expansion, in developing new methods, new tools for transportation, communication, making life more comfortable. But innovation has got one serious problem. Innovation shuts the doors to the past treasures that the great masters in different spiritual traditions have accumulated. So innovation means you can always come forward with a new idea. That new idea in science and technology will be an improvement. But this new idea in life may not be an improvement. So sometimes when we compare our present state of civilization with some early stages in this human civilization, we feel we are gone backward in culture and civilization. So we have gone forward in science and technology. So that's why often I want to discuss this point, the importance of what we call succession. In Sanskrit we call parampara, we may call spiritual inheritance. The treasures, the great masters or different spiritual cultural traditions have left behind. Because in modern times, as we get obsessed with innovation, which is part of scientific temper, scientific culture, we have a tendency to shut the doors to the ancient past. So education, life, all become technology oriented. So anyway, we will discuss this subject in the coming sessions. Now we can have interaction.
It seems like to me, Swamiji, that you talk about prasada.
Prasada.
Yeah. Well, the opposite of that is dukkha, right?
In fact, you know, what we mean by dukkha in Buddhist tradition is not really the opposite of it. When you do not have prasada, you can have dukkha. That's true. But prasada is a state that goes beyond dukkha and also its opposite. Yeah, sukha. Because, that's why prasada, if you want to use a Sanskrit term, equivalent for prasada is atyantikam sukha, means the ultimate transcendental sukha. Transcendental happiness is called prasada.
So prasada is transcendental.
Yeah, it's a transcendental feeling of inner contentment. Yes.
Well, okay. As long as the mind is there,
The
mind's going to force you out of that.
Yes, true.
And you can never hold it. You can never be there.
Yeah.
It's not going to last. True. So it seems to me that the issue is you got to get, as Thakur says, a right mind or get rid of the mind.
Yeah.
And that's extremely difficult, and very few people do it.
True, true. Yeah, you know, that's why this verse which I use, you know, it is called Sukham Atyendigam Yetad Buddhigrahim Atindriyam. You know, Buddhigrahim, Buddhi means here mind.
Mm-hmm.
Buddhi and mind and mana, both are, intellect and mind are used in more or less the same meaning in many of these verses. It says, true mind, refined mind, cultivated mind can understand this ultimate sukha. That's a literal meaning of this verse. Buddhigrahi means that which could be perceived, understood, realized by buddhi. What kind of buddhi? Not ordinary mind, but cultivated, highly evolved mind. What is that mind? That mind is a mind which is ready for this, which has got rid of all the obsessions. I mean, extreme obsession is called raga, and aversion, extreme dvesha. So those who have gone beyond extreme aversion to a certain things and extreme obsessive liking for certain things, it's kind of slavish attachment, those who transcend this will reach a state which is called the ultimate sukha or ultimate happiness. That is what is meant by prasada. In a way, that's why the same verse says it could be realized, it could be understood by mind or buddhi. What is that mind? Not the ordinary mind, which is always going after sensory pleasures, I mean, momentary objective things. But this higher mind, it is cultivated mind. But that's why Sri Ramakrishna says, such a mind eventually take you to the highest goal. Mind becoming your guru, that you in the gospel you may have read it. Mind itself becomes our guru. What mind? Not the mind that takes us in so many different directions. That mind which has become settled, which is linked to the transcendental Atman or God himself. That mind, because it is linked to God, that mind takes you the highest. That's why the same verse says, this ultimate joy, final transcendental joy, is called prasada, can be understood when you transcend these duals, I mean extreme obsession or attachment, liking for certain things, and its opposite, extreme aversion. When mind reaches a kind of tranquility, then mind is linked to God or Atman. Then mind becomes purified. That's why Sri Ramakrishna says, you know, the mind that is purified is your teacher. The mind which is not purified, your enemy. Mind can be our best friend and the worst enemy. The front mind is linked to the highest spiritual ideal. That's why if you read the writings of... Okay, can I give you an example? It's a very, very interesting story. you find, of course, there are many sources in the Vedantic tradition, but I can give an example from Russian mystical tradition, which I quoted a few times earlier. The work is called The Way of a Pilgrim. Yeah, a peasant, an ordinary man, who happened to hear from some source, he went to a church and there was a sermon on the first epistle of St. Paul, where St. Paul speaks of unceasing prayer, where your mind is always naturally in a state of spontaneous prayerfulness linked to God. So that's called prasada. Really, that is their way of interpreting what we call prasada. And he went in search of a teacher who will teach him this. I don't want to go through those details. Eventually, he found a Russian Orthodox Church monk who taught him this. When he learned how to keep his mind in a state of unceasing prayerfulness, he felt a great joy. Actually, he had nothing. He was a poor peasant. Nothing in his. All that he knew was just reading and writing, which he wrote. It became an autobiography, which was found on Mount Athos in Greece, and it was translated into different languages, including English. So the point is, if you read it, you find, after learning the art of unceasing prayer, his whole outlook towards himself and others and life went a complete transformation. He felt joy within. He felt a kind of inner tranquility, inner joy. Those words are very similar to the experience of the great devotee in the Bhagavata, in Prahlada. So when your mind is linked to this higher ideal, slowly it becomes pure. Slowly it gets linked, oriented towards a higher spiritual goal. And then it begins to experience what we call prasada, a kind of inner tranquility. As I mentioned, you know, when you help a blind man to cross the street without a photographer taking your photograph to be given advertised newspapers or expecting a reward from the county, nobody knows about this. In your private mind, you alone are aware of this. When you go back, I have done something fine. What's the experience you get? You cannot get that experience if you pay $1 million. What is that experience? It is called chitta prasada. The meaning is chitta prasada. Chitta means mental system. The same, you mean a higher experience of the same type, same quality the pilgrim had, as mentioned in The Way of a Pilgrim, which a devotee had. That mind is the real mind. The other mind won't take you to the highest goal. That's okay. Okay, please.
On line of this prasada, Swamiji, it's very important for us to have that pure mind. We have to evolve to that level so that we get connected with the buddhi. Yeah. Now, is that... in a way, a grace. You said some transcendental. Yeah. We get some help from the transcendental level. So are we getting grace from up there? And and also, at the same time, are we moving up from our lower nature?
Yeah.
Is that what I'd like to... connected so that, leave your lower nature and try to connect yourself with the buddhi. And for that, it's important for us to have that pure mind and develop that pure mind. And developing the pure mind would be practicing spiritual sadhanas and all that. And that probably would be something that we can, I can get it from other things, but I'd like to know about the grace.
Yeah. In fact, there is a combination and blending, a frictionless blending and harmony of grace and effort. Because without some effort on our part, we won't be able to make use of grace even if God gives you that. So these efforts are necessary to achieve grace-worthiness. That's a very important point to remember. Again, in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, there are a number of stories. Sri Ramakrishna says, you know, if you want to cross the river, you are sitting on this bank of the river. The boat is anchored. You have to untie the chains. You have to row for some distance. And when you reach midstream, then you will be able to make use of the wind that is blowing. But if you are sitting on this bank and just without making any effort, God, please show me grace. Let me be on the other bank. It's not going to happen. So to be able to make use of the wind that is already flowing, even before you started your effort, you should make your own effort. And again, in this, there is a very interesting description of this phenomenon in spiritual life in Sundarese Avila's autobiographical writings. So she takes the example from the life of a farmer. A farmer who wants to irrigate the field. Now, the field is full of thorns, stones, weeds, and so many other wild growth. And he should make his effort to bring water, maybe from a river, by cutting a canal, from a well, a water mill, as in those days. These are all different forms of human effort. Just that we read scriptures, we listen to lectures, we think, and we go to places of worship and pray, and many we discuss with these ideas with fellow spiritual seekers. These are different ways of making our mind ready. But suppose we don't make our mind ready, we won't be able even to make an effort to pray. Coming back to the story, suppose the farmer irrigates the field before and without removing the weeds and grass and stones, he won't get the result. So before he makes his own effort to irrigate the field, he should remove all this from the field. And suppose it starts raining, God's grace. Suppose it starts raining before he has made his own effort to remove the weeds and grass and stones, then also he won't get the expected result. So even to be benefited by God's grace in the form of rains, the field should be made ready first. Like that, our mind should be made ready. And then you find God's grace automatically comes. In devotion scripture, they make a statement that once you get God's grace, then when you look back, you will realize that your own effort was part of God's grace. It was by God's grace that you felt like getting up from your seat, untie the anchor, and take the boat to the midstream. If there was no God's grace, you will be sitting there. It was by God's grace that you removed all the weeds and grass from the field. But this you realize only after receiving God's grace. So before that, if you feel, well, my effort also parts of God's grace, I won't do nothing. Just like saying, you know, suppose you take a vow. If I get $1,000, I will donate $500 to church, some philanthropic society. And then when you're walking in San Francisco street, you get a wallet, $500. Then you say, oh God, you have taken your share already. So this is only my share. I need not. Instead of giving $250 to the church, you take the whole thing because it's your share. So that won't work. That's why, you know, Jung actually completely disowned Freud. And Jung realized the need for faith in God and religion. Then he experimented, but didn't work. Because for experimentation, you believe in God. That is not real belief. So it is not scientifically verifiable. But so the real faith will take you across, then you look back, then you realize that your effort also was made possible by God's grace. But that you realize only when you walk some distance and reach the goal, not before that. That's why a harmonious blending of both. You know, Holy Mother, Sri Sarada Devi, she had to confront different types of disciples. So some disciples went and told her, you know, I'm making a lot of effort, I'm doing japa, taking the name of God, meditation, puja, still I don't make much progress, God, I'm not able to realize God. So that person was making so much of claims of his own effort. Then Mother said, do you think that just because you do all these, God should appear before you? God is like fish and vegetable that you can buy in the market. You pay for $10, you get it. So there the mother was stressing the place of grace in spiritual life. And then in another context, some devotees told Mother, oh, Mother, everything is God's grace. So I need not make much effort. I'm not able to do anything. Then Mother said, look at me, even in the midst of all these responsibilities, I'm doing so much of spiritual sadhana. You should, without your effort, nothing is going to happen. So depending upon the spiritual seeker, this ideal is interpreted. The whole point is, without our effort, our mind will not be ready to receive or to make use of God's grace, or even to recognize God's grace as God's grace. We will interpret it as accident. It happened as accident. To understand it as God's grace, your mind should be ready. Please.
Thank you, Swamiji. Is a purified mind, you were talking about purifying the mind, at that point, does it become buddhi, or is buddhi separate from the mind?
In this particular verse, you know, in many verses, buddhi and mind are used to mean the same thing. So very often, to understand the true meaning, traditional scholars will refer to Shankaracharya's commentary. But in this particular context, buddhi means purified mind. But in many other contexts, mind could mean ordinary mind, which is not purified, which is highly fluctuating, changing.
Okay. Thank you. And one other question. I love the definition of spirituality, gapping the mind to the buddhi. How you explained it?
You mean linking our mind to spiritual ideal, to God, Brahman. Then the mind begins to change. Its confusions, wrong impressions, all this slowly decrease, becomes pure. So when it reaches a very higher level of purity, then becomes calm and calm. So that's the idea.
I love that idea. Could you also use heart instead of buddhi for that?
Heart. You know,
the gap between.
Yes. Yes. The scriptures use this word. Heart may not be the right. In English, of course, they use different terms, you know. Okay. But in this particular context, when we say this particular mind can experience prasada, inner contentment, that mind is purified mind. It is Godward moving mind, spiritually oriented mind.
Thank you.
Nice. One point I want to stress, a very important thing. When you listen to a prayer, or when you yourself pray, or when you read a scripture, a very, very touching message, and you keep the book down, and we look back, you feel something in your mind. What is that? That is prasada. Now, how do you explain it? It is some kind of feeling of inner contentment, soothing effect, refinement, equanimity. You may call it joy in the higher sense. So all these can be used to explain that. In a way, it's beyond explanation, to be very frank. So that is called prasada. So, okay, please.
Swamiji, Atman, they say, is indivisible and changeless. If that is so, what is the effect, as far as the changelessness is concerned, what is the effect of good samskaras on Atman?
Yeah. You know, good samskaras will help you to make the mind ready. It makes the mind ready for understanding that you have a spiritual dimension, you are the Atman. Because it's like, you know, like a mirror. Our mind also actually is non-different from Atman. It is Atman's light. The light from Atman reflects through mind and intellect and even the senses. So, but then when the mind is clouded, like a mirror which is dusty and filthy, then the reflection will be very weak. So the question arises, you know, if Atman is everywhere, Atman is present in everyone, what about the great villains of the world, undesirable characters? Atman is not there. If Atman is everyone, everywhere, in within all, Atman is there. Just like, you know, a mirror which is dirty and filthy. So what happens, you know, maybe some different colors. When the light reflects through the mirror, the light also appears to have changed. It has not changed. But that light reflects through that mirror will assume the color, the cloudiness, of vagueness of that mirror. That's why I'm quoting again to make this point. Swami Vivekananda has a great statement. You know, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. You cannot say there is no Atman in amoeba. There is Atman only in Buddha, because Buddha has realized it. The only difference is, in Buddha, the mirror is pure, no dust. So through his spiritual practices, Buddha in Sanskrit means the enlightened one, also Gautama Buddha. So through his practice, he realized his true dimension, that is the Atman. Though Buddhism is called Anatmavada, that will take it to metaphysics. If that's another session, I can explain. Buddhism really is not Anatmavada. Buddha only said Atman cannot be explained. Anyway, that's a different matter. So the whole point is, coming back to Swami Vivekananda's definition, that the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. The explanation is this. In amoeba, it is manifesting in a very low voltage, in a very low degree. Maybe in great spiritual seekers, it is manifesting in greater effulgence. And in Buddha, in full effulgence. So every spiritual practice, like attending retreats, feeding the mind with spiritual food, by whatever means, by associating with spiritual persons, whatever may be, are like taking a piece of cloth and dusting the mirror of all the filth and dirt, everything. So every spiritual practice is like cleaning up the mirror. So that Atman that is already reflecting will manifest in greater effulgence. That's why as you do spiritual practice, you feel this. You feel more and more that we are getting more and more evolved, higher and higher level of mental purity. And that higher level of purity that is attained will be experienced as a kind of inner fulfillment. As I mentioned, it cannot be explained. Your mind will become calm and quiet. Not immediately, but as we practice, go forward. That's the idea.
You had talked about the way of the pilgrim, and it was my understanding that the way of the ceaseless prayer is the way of the heart. And the woman over here talked about heart. It seems like we're stuck very much in purifying the mind, and we're not talking about heart. Could you respond to that?
I shall explain. In Aaron French translation of the way of pilgrim, he uses the word heart. But maybe in place of purified heart is used in way of pilgrim, Vedantic scriptures like Gita may use buddhi or purified mind. But it practically mean the same. So very often when we use the word heart, when I use this term, people ask, there were doctors in the audience who do heart surgery. You know. They said heart is part of the body. So then I had to tell them, you know, that's not what we really mean. You know. So I had to explain to them. So if you mean by the word heart, what R.M. French translates from Russian into the English word heart while explaining unceasing prayer, whether you're already in a state of spontaneous prayerfulness. But the prayer continues even without this being aware of it. That's how it is explained. Without any effort, the prayer continues spontaneously without any effort on the pilgrim's part. And when he mastered this, you know what he felt first? He felt a great joy in his heart. That's how they explain it. So that heart is what is meant by purified mind or buddhi in our context. It's a problem of language, you know, really. So once you do spiritual practice, you will understand that what the pilgrim means is exactly the same. And he felt great compassion for everyone. Yeah. He felt great compassion for everyone. People, thieves and robbers ambushed him. He didn't feel any vengeance, any hostile feeling. You find the whole explanation you find. And interestingly, in the Bhagavata Purana, there is a description of a little boy, 5-year-old boy, Prahlada, who was the son of a demon, an evil person. He was a great devotee of God. This demon, his own father, tortured him. Tried to punish him for being a devotee of God. That's the point. Taught him to how to tell lies, how to disturb people, all this. You find long description. But Prahlada didn't mind. Then he says, every moment for him was a celebration. When he felt the presence of God in his mind, he said, manized, that could be called purified heart, as used in the way of pilgrim. When he felt the presence of God within him, nityotsavam bhavatesham nityasri nityamangala. What it means? Every day is a day for celebration. Every moment is a moment for celebration. So that's how it calls. You find the same experience the pilgrim explains. When the monk took him to the cell, he says, in the monastery, the Russian Orthodox monk, and taught him this unceasing prayer. When he mastered it, and when he practiced it, he felt the same, a great joy, what we call citta prasada, within him, and a great compassion and love for everyone around. That is what you find, is they run almost parallel to each other. So we will continue the discussion in the afternoon, from 3 to 4:30 again. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.